The following episode of Animal Airwaves Live was recorded at an earlier time. From WUFTFM, this is Animal Airwaves Live, our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, and I'm so happy to welcome to the program today from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Sally Ann Donata. And we're going to be talking today about horses, but specifically about a condition in horses, which, while it might, on the surface, just to a total novice like myself, someone who doesn't really know anything, might not seem like it would be such a big deal, it actually can be quite a big deal. And we're talking today about anhidrosis. And welcome to the program, Dr. Donata. Glad to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Am I correct in saying that this is something that can be quite serious?
Yes, you are absolutely correct. And it's a relatively common condition here in Central Florida and certainly the southeastern United States. And it's of particular importance in the summer months.
And when we talk about anhidrosis, what are we talking about specifically?
So anhidrosis refers to either the temporary or permanent loss of the ability to sweat.
Now, for people who have cats and dogs, well, this might not seem like it should be such a big deal. Our cats and dogs don't really sweat per se, but with horses, it is a big deal. Why?
Well, it is a big deal for horses because sweating is actually their primary mechanism of thermal regulation, or essentially how they dissipate excessive heat when they are overheated in the summer months. And while it seems like an obvious physiologic process for humans, because we sweat certainly most of the summer months in Florida and in hot, humid conditions, it's actually a pretty unique physiological way to regulate one's temperature. Believe it or not, only three mammalian species, horses, humans, and the Erythrocebus patus monkey, are the only three mammals that use sweat as the primary thermoregulatory mechanism. And so we know dogs pant. I think cats pant too. I'm trying to think of cats that I've had, they mostly just live in a nice air-conditioned
environment. Yeah, they can pant for sure. Cats who get overheated will pant. Yeah, no doubt about it. But this is...
Sweating seems like such a common thing, but only because humans are one of the few mammalian species that use it, so that rely on it in order to stay cool in the summertime. But horses certainly do as well, and they don't enjoy the air-conditioned environment that most of us people do.
Unless they're very fancy. No. So this is completely fascinating. I've been doing this show for 10 years, and this is one of the most fascinating tidbits I've ever heard on the program. And I don't know how I've lived to be a middle-aged man and not known that there are so few species that sweat. And of course, it makes total sense that as human beings, we've sort of centered our own experience as people who sweat. And it is... defies our own sort of comprehension that there would be such a thing as problems associated with sweating. And yet it is easy to understand how if one's ability to thermoregulate is dependent almost entirely on sweating, then not having that ability would be potentially catastrophic if the animal is in an environment in which it is otherwise out of its control, the temperature, right? So horses.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, horses are in barns or they're out in pastures, and it's not hard to imagine, especially on a summer day like today, that it can very quickly get intolerably hot if you don't have a way to control your own temperature.
And horses are even at a greater disadvantage when compared to humans. When you think about, they actually have a fur hair coat on their skin, and so that acts to trap excessive heat. They have a very large body mass compared to humans, and so they're generating quite a bit of core temperature or core heat all the time that needs to be dissipated. They don't have access to air condition for the most part, and they're also often dark-skinned and have dark hair coats. And so when they're out in the pasture or the paddocks during the day, have access to variable amounts of shade, or they might be in direct sunlight, their propensity to truly overheat and reach core body temperatures of 105 degrees or more can happen really quite quickly. And anhidrosis can actually, in that scenario, be a life-threatening health emergency.
So before we get too far into it, what is a horse's normal sort of body temperature if everything is okay?
We say around 100.5 degrees, and that can range depending on time of day and even the age of the horse. We know that younger foals can tend to be a little bit higher body temp than adult horses, but right around between 99 and 101 is usually the normal range. So they're a little warmer than humans, but not much.
And as you say, they do spend a good deal of time, many horses, in the sun. And like people, when exposed to very warm temperatures, the sweating is what cools us off. Can you describe a bit how the sort of sweating mechanism works?
Yeah, sure. So horses, like humans, their skin is diffusely covered or infiltrated with sweat glands. And these sweat glands are responsible for, they act in response to hormones that are in the body circulation. Epinephrine is one that is quite important. So this is a stress hormone that happens in response to increased body temperature. And when epinephrine gets released into the bloodstream by the adrenal glands, which are in the abdomen of the horse, it stimulates sweat glands throughout the horse's or the human's body to start releasing both electrolytes, proteins, and water content. And that results in the actual sweat that you see bead up on your skin.
And this sweat, go ahead.
I was going to say then the effect of having that bead of sweat on your skin actually conducts heat via evaporation.
Right. So not in Florida so much, but in other places where the ambient sort of air is a bit drier than Florida, ideally that sweat does evaporate, and that evaporation makes you feel cool. And, you know, of course, here in Florida, where the humidity or the dew point is so high anyway, it doesn't work quite as well as many of us would wish. And in effect, I mean, like, how often have, we had that feeling where we're sweaty and it just doesn't seem to cool us down very much. But nevertheless, it is doing its job to a great degree. Even if we still feel uncomfortable, the horse and we need this sweating in order to prevent our bodies from just kind of having the temperature kind of spiral out of control. How and why does this anhidrosis occur in horses? Is it well understood?
Well, yes and no. There's quite a bit of pretty interesting research that goes on here at the University of Florida because Florida is an epicenter for this condition in horses. And the research has been going on for over a decade now, both here at the vet school. Dr. Rob Mackay and his team traditionally looked at a lot of the different horses across the Southeast and looked for risk factors and whether there was perhaps reason to believe this was a genetic condition in horses or what management practices could be contributing to the development of anhidrosis. And then more recently, Dr. Samantha Brooks, who is an equine geneticist, which is a pretty special profession. There aren't very many of them across the world, and we're lucky to have our own equine geneticist right here at UF. So Dr. Samantha Brooks is in the animal science department, and one of her areas of research is understanding the heritability and genetic basis for anhidrosis. And she recently has published some pretty interesting papers that I think are getting us much closer to understanding actually the molecular basis of why these sweat glands essentially stop working in affected horses. So when we think about anhidrosis, there are transient or sort of one-off episodes. And so a horse that perhaps has an abnormality in their electrolytes or perhaps had one episode of overexertion where they essentially overused their sweat glands, those horses may develop transient anhidrosis where they can't sweat quite enough, but it resolves on its own. We know that there are certain medications that we use as well for other conditions that have one of the side effects is that they dampen the sweat gland response. And a few of those have been known and actually their effects on the sweat glands have been quantified. And resolving anhidrosis in those horses is as simple as making sure that they're getting electrolyte supplementation, and perhaps discontinuing any medications that might be secondarily causing the sweat glands to have a subnormal function. The real trouble is what we call chronic idiopathic anhidrosis, or CIA. And these are horses that lose the ability to sweat either partially or in the more severe forms fully. So absolutely no sweat production at all. And this is over a course of more than one summer season. And they may or may not resolve, get better, or many of them may even get worse and progress to total anhidrosis year after year after year. And those horses don't have any known risk factor that we can improve in their lifestyle or their management or their diet. So they actually have a true inherent defect, we think, of their sweat glands. And those are the horses that are at most risk for having the deleterious health effects of chronically not being able to regulate their body heat in the summer. And also the horses that often end up needing to move up to cooler climates so that they can just be comfortable and have an adequate quality of life in the summertime.
Yeah. Okay. So those horses that have this, what did you describe it as, idiopathic?
Yeah. Just means we don't exactly know why it happens.
Yeah. No, those horses, are you saying that the onset won't be total immediately, that it will instead kind of ramp up over a little while?
There's both versions. So some horses slowly over time progressively lose their ability to sweat, where it might not be obvious at first, or it might be a reduced ability that then progresses to total anhidrosis. Although there are also horses that where it can happen fairly acutely or fairly quickly. And many of those horses have had an episode of profuse sweating, sometimes in response to a heavy exercise or overexertion. And then they lose the ability to sweat completely following that episode of excessive sweat production. And so those horses, there's a theory that perhaps it is overexertion or burnout of those sweat glands. And so we know that many of the different hormonally responsive glands throughout the body, if you overstimulate them chronically, they will downregulate their response. And so you can essentially overexert a hormonally responsive gland, and that it might be that these horses have an episode of increased excessive sweat production, and their sweat glands then are injured in some way and lose the ability to respond to the hormones that normally would stimulate them to continue to create sweat.
I'm about to ask such a dumb question because I've lived my whole life in one of our country's most sweaty locations, but I've never paid close attention to actually like where the sweat is coming from. Are these glands located all over the skin? I mean, are there just thousands of them?
Yeah, probably millions.
Wow.
And in horses, they are concentrated in the neck areas, in the flanks. If you have a horse in the summertime in Florida, it's not uncommon to walk out and see the horses are actually glistening in the sunshine because they are truly dripping with sweat. They are completely wet. Humans have sweat glands that are concentrated in sort of regional areas throughout the body. Interestingly, dogs that don't use whole body sweating as a method for thermoregulation, they actually have sweat glands, but they're in their paw pads.
Right.
Believe it or not.
Yeah.
So dogs' paws can sweat, but the rest of the body doesn't.
Yeah. There's so much more to talk about, but here's where we're going to take our first break. I want to remind listeners that this is Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM. My name is Dana Hill. I'm speaking with Sally Ann Donato from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Animal Airwave Live here on WUFT. WFTFM. This is our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill. My guest today from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine is Dr. Sally Ann Donata, and we're talking today about anhidrosis in horses, the circumstance in which they lose their ability to sweat, which, as we've learned so far, can be a very serious problem. And I wonder, Dr. Donata, how is this first discovered in most individual horses that have this? Do people notice the horses behaving strangely? Does someone who's perhaps a trainer or a horse's owner go outside and not see that sort of characteristic glistening that you'd expect to see on a summer day?
Yeah, absolutely. And in some horses, it's really quite obvious. If you have a herd of horses, we actually have a herd of teaching horses here at the university. And if you go out on a hot day, most of them will be sort of sweaty and glistening in the sunshine. And we do have a couple anhidrosis horses here, and they will have this characteristic kind of dry, and sometimes even the hair coat itself can appear kind of frazzled and sun bleached in comparison to horses that are, remember, sweat isn't just water. It also has electrolytes, protein, and oils. And so a hair coat that doesn't have any excess or any contact with sweat gets kind of a dry, sun-bleached appearance. Some horses will start to actually lose their hair. We call that, it's called alopecia, where you'll have areas of just bare skin, perhaps from heat stress or as part of the disease complex. But in the studies that have been performed where they survey thousands of horses and look for what is unique, what are the clinical signs of the horses that have anhidrosis, increased respiratory rate and effort, or tachypnea, is the most commonly reported initial clinical sign by the owners of the horses that are affected by anhidrosis. And that makes physiologic sense. The horses can't dissipate their body heat by sweating, and so they switch to a less efficient but partially effective method. They start breathing hard to try to move air across their lungs and their pulmonary system to try to dissipate heat that way, similar to how a dog would pant.
Right. And then the experienced horse trainer or owner, in my experience doing this program, many of them are quite well informed. They might recognize that this is a problem that warrants investigation.
They do. And the interesting thing about anhidrotic horses is their initial clinical signs can mimic other common health crises in horses. So horses that have colic, which I know you and I have chatted about before, Dana, they have a bellyache, and they can have an increased respiratory rate because they have pain in their abdomen, or pneumonia or an infection can cause a horse to have a rapid increased breathing rate, again, from either infection in the pulmonary system or generalized pain. And so many owners, once they notice their horse isn't acting quite right, they may try to feed them to see how is their appetite. And many anhidrotic horses have a reduced appetite, and they may drink less or more water than normal, depending on the horse. And owners will often then get a thermometer and take the horse's temperature as part of a general physical exam. And then they may notice that the temperature can be 103, 104, even upwards of 105 degrees. And at that point, certainly recognizing that things are pretty abnormal, they may call their veterinarian and say, my horse seems to be colicking, or my horse has a fever. And when in truth, the horse is actually just truly overheating.
So what would be, at that point, assuming that you've made the call to a veterinarian, what could you do right then in the moment for that horse? Could you maybe cool it with some water?
Yeah. And when an owner calls a vet in the Florida area, if a central Floridian veterinarian, when anybody calls about their horse with a fever this time of year, the first thing we ask is your horse sweating? Or is your horse dry? And I'm from the Northeast and the Northwest originally. And so anhidrosis wasn't a condition that I had ever even seen before in practice before coming to Florida 3 years ago. So it took me as a vet a while to get used to asking that question, because the horses up north generally sweating is not a problem. Now I've gotten into the habit, and sure enough, if the owner comes back and says, yes, the horse is lathered and sweaty, then you might go down a different pathway diagnostically or from a diagnostic standpoint. But if the horse is, if the owner says, you know what, you're right, the horse is dry and is not sweating, then the first thing we usually have them do is just do a cold water rinse on the horse, bring them inside, give them access to fresh cold water to drink. Getting some cool water internally is important as much as it is to rinse them on the outside. And then getting them under fans can help cool them down as well.
Right, because the fans can help the process of evaporation that will make the horse feel cooler, if I understand correctly.
Yes, they do the work that the Florida weather pattern doesn't do on its own.
Yeah, right.
When it's hot and sticky and still here, adding a fan can be really helpful for helping that conductive heat evaporation process.
Yeah, I mean, anybody who's been to an outdoor event that has had one of these, what do they call them sometimes, swamp coolers or something, they're like big fans that yeah. also have some water dripping, and the mist plus the air moving over you kind of helps you feel quite a bit cooler, even though the, you know, outside temperature is still the same. You're still feeling cooler because of that evaporation. Let's say the owner says, no, my horse isn't sweating. You ask them to kind of go to cool that horse off in some way. What happens next? A visit from the veterinarian, or does somebody have to bring a horse into a specialty clinic?
Yeah. Getting a full history on the horse is probably the first step. We know from some of the studies that have been done here at the university that horses that come from northern cooler climates down to the south, particularly in the hot months, if they're not allowed to acclimate slowly to this hot, humid environment, they are at much higher risk of developing anhidrosis. Probably just their sweat glands are not acclimated to our humidity and our environment, and aren't able to do the workload that a native Floridian horse sweat glands may be doing on a day-to-day basis from, you know, May to October, really, are our heavy, hot and humid months here, of course. Talking about what kind of dietary management their horse is on, are they supplementing with salt and electrolytes and things that we know are important here in Florida in the summer to help compensate for some of the electrolytes that are lost in excessive day-to-day sweating? There are certain breeds that are predisposed, so warm bloods and thoroughbreds are several times higher risk than Arabians, quarter horses, and some of our native Floridian breeds. And a lot of that has been examined more closely by Dr. Brooks' genetic lab, where they're looking at actually trying to understand which specific channel or cell membrane mechanism is causing the reduction in sweat production. And so often anhidrotic horses can be diagnosed just from talking to the owner of the phone, because a horse that doesn't sweat is a horse that doesn't sweat. But if the horse has only partially lost their ability to sweat, and so they may sweat sometimes but not in others, they may seemingly overheat or have an excessively difficult time recovering from even a mild or moderate amount of exercise, we can perform a medical test. It's called the quantitative intradermal tributyline sweat test. And that's where we actually administer a small amount, a very, very small amount of a medication called tributyline, which mimics the beta adrenergic hormones that stimulate sweat glands to work. And we inject that under the skin of the neck in several different concentrations. And then we can actually measure the sweat production at each site where we injected the different concentrations of tributyline. And so that's a really nice quantifiable way to compare horses to what we know are known normal sweat levels and sweat production levels. And horses that have anhidrosis will either have reduced sweat production at some or all of the tributyline injection sites.
Okay, so if I understand this correctly, this tributyline is some sort of chemical that, when administered, will provoke a sweat response, right?
Yes. And when you inject it under the skin, they sweat right at that site.
Right at that site. Okay. And so then if you inject it there, and this, a normal horse will sweat at a rate that has been measured amongst enough horses, I guess, that you have a kind of standard level, right? That will help you understand that if a horse is not sweating that much, then it probably is experiencing anhidrosis to a greater or lesser degree. Is
exactly.
That okay?
So years ago, Dr. Mackay, when he started studying this condition, he took a series of normal horses, horses that were known to sweat under all conditions, all months of the year. And he did the intradermal terbutaline sweat test on those horses every month for an entire year. And by doing that study, he was able to not only establish what a normal, roughly what the sweat response was in a normal horse, but also show how that sweat response may differ from month to month, because it would make sense back then to think maybe a horse would have an increased sweat response in the summer than it did in the winter. And in the end, there is very little variation month to month, but that was an important study that now enables us to compare horses that we think might have anhidrosis to those normal reference range standards.
Yeah, and that's just a wonderful example of the scientific process, too, of working to kind of figure that out. So you might give one of these injections to a horse, maybe in various parts, I don't know, if you need to do that, of the horse's body, and you will determine whether or not its sweat production is encumbered in some way. And do you often find that it is when you do these tests?
Yeah, this is a shockingly common condition in Florida. And again, these came from large, several thousand horses being surveyed for some of these big, what we call epidemiological studies, where you try to understand a disease on a population level. And what they found was on a farm level, so around 10% of the farms in the Southeast and Florida have a horse affected by anhidrosis. And on the horse level, around 2% of the population of horses in Florida have some degree of anhidrosis. So when you think about 2 out of every 100 horses, 1 out of every 10 farms, that's a lot of horses that aren't sweating appropriately in the heat of the summer.
Yeah. And as you say, being, you know, if you're up north, well, maybe that's not so big a deal. But here it can be quite a big deal. Can we just take a diversion a second to ask about what it is about up north that makes it to where you weren't seeing this very much? Is it just that the number of really, really hot days was not considerable, so then though it wasn't such a big deal to horses whether they could sweat or not? Or is there something that's really just different about horses up north versus horses here?
Well, there is probably a genetic component to this. We know that horses that have family members with anhidrosis are much more likely to have anhidrosis themselves. And certainly knowing that there are breed dispositions supports the idea that certain bloodlines or there is a genetic component. But it's probably also environmental in that it's not necessarily the horses up in the north have different sweat glands, but their sweat glands may face different environmental and physiologic stress and demands than they do down here. And so a horse that may have sweated normally in the summertime in the northern states, because it still, of course, does get warm all over our country, certainly in the summer. And horses need to sweat when they exercise too. So even if you're in a cool environment, if you go out and exercise, your horse, they're going to get sweaty and lathered up as a normal physiologic response to that increased core temp that's generated from physical exertion. But those horses may come down and lose their ability to sweat when they're in the Southeast. And that supports this environmental effect theory, where it might be that the sweat glands are actually getting overstimulated, chronically overstressed, and actually either downregulate or lose their ability to respond to the normal hormonal stimulus to produce sweat.
Well, here's where we're going to take our second break. I want to remind listeners that this is Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM. I'm Dana Hill. My guest today from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine is Dr. Sally Ann Donata. We're talking about anhidrosis in horses. We'll be back right after this. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM. My name is Dana Hill. My guest today from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine is Dr. Sally Ann Donata, and we're talking about anhidrosis in horses when they lose their ability to sweat and how it can be a really big problem. So, Dr. Donata, let's just say now that you have diagnosed a horse with anhidrosis, that all the things, all the check boxes are ticked, and you have determined that this is a horse that really is experiencing limitations in its ability to sweat. Well, where do you go from there?
Yeah, and this is where hopefully in the coming years, some of the research that's happening at the university will help us understand preventative strategies and perhaps how to stop this disease before it becomes a clinical problem in horses, because as we'll chat about, our management strategies are really pretty limited. The first thing we usually do is try to develop strategies for owners to keep the horses where they are, so here in Central Florida, and ways to keep them cool and still be able to use them, whether that be recreational riding or competitive riding. And so that may include exercising them early in the morning or late in the evening when it's when the ambient temperature is at its coolest. Certainly these horses benefit from aggressive environmental management. So fans, misters, we have a sprinkler system out in our paddock here at UF that the anhidrotic horse, you can pick the anhidrotic horses out of the herd pretty easily because they're the ones that all summer long stand under the sprinkler, which helps them, of course, cool off. And then making sure that the horses have a balanced diet that includes electrolytes, particularly salt, so sodium and chloride and potassium that they need to combat what they would normally be losing in sweat. And those electrolytes are important for cellular function and maintaining water balances both within the cell and outside of the cell. Some people have turned to homeopathic methods. So acupuncture is a relatively common and popular therapy for anhidrotic horses. They did look at some of these acupuncture and other supplements over the past several years, and there hasn't been a scientific study yet that's been able to show that any one homeopathic method is more helpful than not. However, I have several owners and veterinarians that we work with who have felt that it's been helpful in individual horses. So it certainly, I don't think, is something that hurts to try. And if it's helpful, then that's great. And then from there, it really just depends on how affected the horse is. It might be that they really can't be athletes or be exercised in the summertime, which is of course, a bit of a bummer for owners that may want to actually enjoy their horses and use them in the summer. Or in the most severe cases or complete anhidrotic horses that we really just can't manage and can't do their job in these warmer climates, they may actually have to go up north where they're not facing such environmental pressure to produce sweat in order to stay at a healthy body temp. And so sometimes that might be that they travel up to the north only when it's warm and humid down here in Florida. So they become snowbirders, if you will. Or sometimes in the more severe cases, those horses actually end up having to change owners, and they're sold to northern climates where they can be more comfortable and have a better quality of life. And some horses will go up to the north. Their sweat glands will undergo what we consider to be some sort of a physiologic rest period. And then they may actually regain the ability to sweat up in the northern climates, whereas some horses will remain anhidrotic for life, no matter where they live.
Mm. Now, is it safe to say that a truly anhidrotic horse will cease to be able to do some of the more intense sports if that horse was involved in that previously?
They may be able to do it in a cooler climate, mm-hmm. but certainly a horse that has no ability to sweat won't be running any races in the summertime in Florida. Their body temps would just get way, way too high, and they'd be facing potentially fatal heat stroke.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it as sad as it is to think that, you know, a person who lives here might have to give up a horse to send it up north. I think anybody who has left Florida in the summertime to take a vacation to a more northern location will recall that, you know, notwithstanding some of the recent heat waves that we've seen up north, and we're coming off a weekend here in which, like, temperatures in the Pacific Northwest reached well over 100 degrees, be that as it may, you know, I think that many of us have also experienced the circumstance of, you know, going somewhere up north in the summertime and finding remarkably, like, pleasant weather sometimes. Or if not just the temperature is lower, that sometimes, you know, you can go to a place where, you know, maybe the humidity is a bit more tolerable or something like that. So it's good to know that there are options for horses. And I'm intrigued, especially, Dr. Tornado, about the idea that a horse may be sent to a cooler place for a while might regain some of its ability to sweat. Is it merely that, you know, the system of, you know, sweat glands and so forth just kind of needs a break, and it can maybe recover from whatever it is that has impaired it in the past?
Giving the sweat glands a physiologic break can truly be really helpful. And horses that are not sweating at all down here in Florida may go up, rest a few seasons up north, and then be able to sweat what we would consider normally up in a northern climate. That doesn't mean that they can come back down and have a normal sweating profile or ability down in Florida again. Most horses, once they're up in the north, they stay up in the north, and they can be quite happy, quite healthy up there. And it is an unfortunate outcome, certainly, for an owner here in Florida who probably loves their horse and would like to ride and enjoy them and perhaps show them or compete. But I think a lot of owners, after trying the management strategies, which can be really pretty intensive, having to cool a horse down, bathe them several times a day, keep them under fans. Not only is that taxing on the owner, but seeing the horses repeatedly overheat, most people want their horses to be have a good quality of life. And everybody knows how miserable you feel when you're overheated and it's hot and sticky and you can't get if you can't get cool. And so most folks are pretty supportive of getting their horse to an environment where they can be a bit healthier. There, we are increasingly realizing that there is a genetic component to this disease. So a sweat gland that may have subpar abilities to produce sweat, it may just be that the sweat glands are not equipped for Central Florida, but they do just fine up north. And some of the work that has very recently come out of Dr. Brooks's lab with the work of one of her recent graduate students, who is now an equine geneticist herself, Dr. Laura Patterson-Rosa, suggests that they're actually narrowing in on a true ion channel in the sweat gland that processes potassium, so one of those all-important electrolytes that we talk about. And it might be that the sweat glands have altered potassium conduction or production across the cell membrane of the cells within that sweat gland. And they haven't sorted out the mechanism exactly quite yet, but they're getting close. It's really exciting research.
It is fascinating. And it's you know, it's not only the genetic component, there's so much that's a chemistry component to all of this as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it makes me wonder whether if the mechanisms of anhidrosis are understood and the genetic component gets to be understood and the chemistry component gets to be understood, whether or not there could be someday solutions in the form of perhaps medical therapies that mm-hmm. would allow these sweat glands to not shut down this way. Do you think that that's something that could be on the horizon?
I think so. I remain medically hopeful, of course, that hopefully they'll discover not only the mechanism behind anhidrosis, but then from that develop some methods for perhaps preventing it. Some of that can be, if we can understand how it's genetically passed from one generation to the next, then we could potentially strategically try to breed it out of populations. If we know they can, if horses can be tested for a certain genetic profile or defect, then that horse could be preferentially not bred into the next generation. And so you can eliminate or reduce the prevalence of a genetic disease just with strategic breeding, which we can do in animals, not so much in people, right? So that's one way that we could reduce the incidence of this disease on a population level. There is also, there are pharmaceutical and medication therapies for what we, these are a group of diseases called channelopathies, which is kind of a fun word to say, but it refers to the channels and the pores in cell membranes that are responsible for moving electrolytes and ions and water transport across the cell. And there are various different channelopathies in human medicine and veterinary medicine alike. And so if they can figure out the exact channel, that the ion channel that is responsible for anhidrosis, and who's to say that we couldn't develop a therapy to alleviate the downstream effects of that channel not working.
Is it well understood at what percentages or ratios it is more likely to be found, anhidrosis, that is, in some of these breeds that you mentioned, like warm bloods and so forth?
Yeah, warm bloods and thoroughbreds are the most common breeds to be affected by anhidrosis, and particularly when you compare them to some of the native Floridian species. And the Arabian was in the epidemiological studies that have been published, the Arabian is grossly underrepresented in the anhidrosis affected group. And so Arabians are thought to be quite protected from anhidrosis. And we don't know for sure why that is, and certainly hypothesize about evolutionarily. The Arabian horse, it's a very old breed, one of the original horse breeds on the planet. And they they came to be in the Middle East. And so it might be that those horses evolutionarily evolved to be more tolerant of the high heat climate of the Middle East, as opposed to some of our newer breeds like the quarter horse and the warm blood.
If long term, the potential for combating anhidrosis, if the solutions might be found in understanding the mechanisms of this disease a little bit better and the genetic component of it, do you know where the sort of thought came to look at this from a genetic perspective came from?
Well, I think that when the epidemiological studies were performed now 10 years ago, it became very clear that one of the risk factors for affected horses was having another horse in their family tree. Nice thing about having registered pedigreed horses, which is a common thing, is we have these beautiful family trees. We know generation to generation which animals are related and how they're related to each other. And so from a genetic standpoint and a hereditary standpoint, that's an important thing to know when you're trying to discover, is this disease, can it be passed from one generation to the next? And by what mechanism? Is it an autosomal dominant or recessive trait, which means does one or both of your parents need to have this genetic defect in order for you to actually be either affected by a disease or perhaps just a carrier where you yourself don't have a certain disease, but you could pass it on then to the next generation. And so they very clearly showed that there is a familial effect and that it puts you at increased risk as a horse to have anhidrosis if some of the animals that you're related to are also affected. And so Dr. Brooks's lab took genetic samples from many, many, many horses and looked at their, they did a genome-wide association study, or GWAS, where they actually sequence all of those horses and look at what are the trends in the genetic profile of the horses that have anhidrosis versus the ones that don't. And they were able to find some target areas that were different between the horses with the disease and without. And from there, they figured out what those areas in the genetic code that are unique to the horses that have anhidrosis, what types of proteins does that genetic code actually create in the animal, or what does it code for? And that is how they found this potassium channel. And interestingly, this is also all work out of Dr. Brooks's lab, so I can't take credit for any of this, but I'm proud to be her colleague, certainly. When you take mice models, which are used extensively in genetic studies, if you genetically engineer a mouse line to not have those particular potassium channels, those mice have a dramatically reduced number of functional sweat glands in their foot pads, which is where mice have their sweat glands. And so it really gives a lot of support to the idea that that potassium channel has at least a contributory role in sweat gland function in other species. Of course, a horse is not a mouse and a mouse is not a horse, but these are some of the models that we use to try to understand what these proteins and what these channels are actually functionally doing on an animal level. And any research of any kind, genetic or pharmaceutical or just general medical research, every time you answer a question, you come up with five more in the process.
Yes.
And so there are so many questions to still yet be answered. And so I certainly encourage anybody out there that has an anhydrotic horse or wants to learn more or wants to support the research that the university does to look online. And Dr. Brooks's lab has some really great information about anhydrosis. They publish a ton of information for owners and veterinarians alike. And certainly supporting their research helps us further the health of the horse here in Florida and everywhere.
Well, Dr. Sally Donato from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, thank you so much for talking to me. This was totally fascinating. And I hope that, you know, if we talk again in, say, 10 years, there will have been strides made and we'll know a bit more about this condition. And maybe even there will be new therapies for it. So thank you for talking to me today.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to
say, Dana, have a great day.
Yeah, you too. And I want to say thank you to Sarah Carey at the UF College of Veterinary Medicine for her help with the program. I'm Dana Hill. I hope you'll join me again next time for another episode of Animal Airwaves Live. Bye-bye.